to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 751, I think, and my name is Camden Busey, of that I'm sure. And I'm in Liberty, Libertyville, Illinois, in the new headquarters, actually in the podcast studio within the headquarters. I guess this is some odd version. I wouldn't want to liken it necessarily to the Holy of Holies in any sanctified sense, but it is kind of in the center of the building. So this is where the action happens, and we have with us here a very important guest, a friend. We have Dr. Daryl Hart, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College, who was just here last week for 3 days recording a course, but now that he's gone home, we have him back remotely to record a podcast. Welcome, Daryl. It's good to see you again.
Thanks. Good to be with you again. Kind of missed the time there. It was fun to be there for a couple nights and hang out with you guys.
Thanks. Yeah, we had a really, really excellent time. I enjoyed it immensely. We got to go out a few nights for a couple nice dinners and recording a course. I should let the cat out of the bag. I've already done it on Twitter, but we have recorded a course on J. Gresham Machen. J. Gresham Machen and the Presbyterian Controversy is a working title. Daryl delivered 12 superb lectures, roughly 30 minutes, some of them 25, some of them 35, but they're all in the 30-minute ballpark. And the point of that is that we are producing a video curriculum for mainly adult Sunday school. It doesn't have to be adults, but it's turning out well. I was just editing the videos yesterday. The audio sounds good. The video's looking great. So I've got backups in multiple places. So as long as nothing catastrophic happens here, like the office explodes or something like that, then we're looking, you know, thankfully, no technical problems, and we're looking at some really, really wonderful footage to back up this excellent content. So overall, Daryl, what did you think about the experience? You can be honest, because if you say something I don't like, I'll just cut it out.
It's just odd for me. I mean, on the one hand, it was, I've taught intensively before at both Westminster's, for instance, and even in Presbyterian Seminary in Brazil, in Sao Paulo, way back when. But even then, there's a kind of, you know, you do it over the course of a week, 3 hours a day. This was pretty much 1.5 days, which was fine. It made sense of all the logistics, but it's hard to keep material, at least in my head, keep it all straight.
Sure.
I'm sort of working on this lecture, and then I've got
next thing
seven
you know.
Others to give today, and I'm trying to remember what might be coming and if I'm duplicating myself. Plus, I'm not listening to myself talk, but I can't imagine anyone listening to me for that long. But over the course of a semester, or you know,
it's spread out,
three
it's
hours
distributed.
A week, you can sort of put up with the guy. So, and that's the way people will consume this.
Sure.
They won't necessarily what's
binge,
it called when you
binge watch?
You binge watch,
binge watch Daryl Hart.
I doubt they'll be doing that, but anyway, this was like a binge give, binge lecture.
I've done something similar,
but that's my experience. It's not going to be anyone else, and it's fine. I mean, that's what I signed up for.
It is odd, and I mentioned it is. There's a certain measure of or level of artifice to it as well, because we're in a room, and we try to make it look not like a prison, and so you end up with a little fake set and like the teaching company or what they used to call the great courses, that kind of thing. So you want to make it look decent on video, but then you're also sitting there teaching to cameras. So as a teacher, it is a little bit unusual. We're looking in the future to hopefully come, I think August, to have some in-person courses. Mm-hmm. And that's going to change the dynamic of how things are recorded and how they work. But overall, I think the course you just taught is spectacular. I like how it comes across. I mean, it feels close and intimate. I mean, Daryl, it's more of a documentary style in terms of how we shot it. Daryl's sitting down in a chair, and we've got three camera angles, and he's just talking through Machen, going through different threads of the things that Machen fought and what prepared him to fight those battles. And I think overall, it's going to be a wonderful course and a great blessing to people who
want
to
watch it. And I would say, aside from my own experience of the logistics, it was really useful and even invigorating to go back through the material and prepare for it, even though I wound up using older notes and lectures than the ones I'd actually prepared to give, which I thought were the ones I was preparing the week before were maybe more just too much Presbyterian history and not enough Machen. And he's obviously a big part of the controversy in the 20s and 30s. So you're doing both. But still, it was some of the old fire for me from grad school days and just really admiring Machen, being convinced by his arguments and seeing what he was up against and what he tried to do was really great. I was really glad to go back through that material. And and so, you know, what we're going to talk about today, John Meether, who couldn't be with us, and I don't want to steal your thunder from this, but RTS is doing online a kind of symposium on the 100th anniversary of Fosdick's, Harry Emerson Fosdick's Shall a Fundamentalist Win?
Yes.
A pretty important sermon. And it was really, I forgot about my deadline, to be honest. Ah. And so I had to crank it out really quickly, but I was very well prepared, I thought, by virtue of having given these lectures recently and gone back through a lot of the material. That was another reason why it was beneficial to me.
Oh, good. You know, I'm glad that that was helpful in that way. I mean, you had taught a course at Calvary OPC on Machen, probably in 2008 or 9?
10, actually.
Maybe 10. Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
It's all blurring together. I'm starting to enter those.
Well, I wouldn't have known that. I only have it, you know, dated on my the
notes.
The file dates that I have. But go ahead.
It turned out well. And so it was wonderful for me to to hear revamped lectures. Some of the materials similar, the same. Obviously, you're reworking it. But regardless of what you've done and your context to change or augment that material, you know, me as a listener, I'm in a much different place and position than I was 12 years ago too, having read a lot more of Machen and the surrounding historical context. So I think this is a course that hits at many different levels. Someone who doesn't know about Machen at all, who still listen or watch the course and learn quite a bit, but someone who's been around the block with even OPC history is certainly going to learn quite a bit and be able to contextualize things. And I appreciate how you structured it too, rather than just going straight chronological. It's not scattershot either, but you're pulling on a thread. And you do that frequently in a lot of your books, you and John do too, where you have a theme in a chapter and you carry that theme through. And then you work through another theme in a subsequent chapter, which might overlap chronologically with the previous chapter, but you end up, I think, learning the history and its significance better in context that way. So I appreciated that. It was really good.
Yeah. That's one of the challenges I find of writing history is that if you just tell the story, you lose the themes. Mm-hmm. But if you emphasize the themes, you lose the story. You get things out of sequence such a big part of understanding the past is understanding the moment and what was possible then. And if you somehow read 1927 back into 1922,
right,
you're doing something anachronistic. So you have to somehow try to represent 1922 without giving it away what's going to happen in 1927 as if it's somehow inevitable, but it may be similar themes. So anyway, that's the challenge of writing history. It's not rocket science, but there is
it's an art.
There's some creativity to it, which I enjoy. It keeps me coming back, obviously.
Good. Yeah, well, keep at it. We are talking today about Harry Emerson Fosdick and his infamous sermon, Shall the Fundamentalists Win? If you're listening to this when this episode comes out, at least when I plan for it to come out, will be Friday, May 20th. So 2022. Saturday, May 21st, 2022 will mark the 100th anniversary of Fosdick having preached this sermon. Fosdick is an extremely important figure, at least in the history of the fundamentalist modernist controversy or debate. We're going to talk about him today and try to put him into context with Presbyterian history in particular. But just to get people started, I would encourage you to read Ned Stonehouse's summary of these events. You can find them in chapter 18 of J. Gresham Machen, a biographical memoir, which is the significant and important book that the biography of Machen that Stonehouse wrote. Took 17 years to write it, and he knew Machen very well. There is a copy available through Banner of Truth, but I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't pump the book that we have available, published through the Committee for the Historian of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. So copies of that are available at opc.org. We can make sure to get you affordable copies out there soon. But Darryl,
so what's the best way to
order?
You're not celebrating the anniversary if you're a conservative Presbyterian. So
I know.
What do you do?
What do we do? What,
do you go out and protest? You rally at the Capitol, or
do we preach a Clarence McCartney sermon on Sunday? You know, shall unbelief win? What do we do? That's a good question.
Even if you set off fireworks, I mean, fireworks is what we do to celebrate the nation's birth. So, and you don't want to drink a toast. So it's an odd thing of how to mark a date that you're angry about.
Maybe to steal Robert Churchill's title, lest we forget. Maybe that's it. It's a sober remembrance.
We wear black armbands on Saturday. Maybe I'll do that. I'm giving some talks at a Presbyterian OP church down in Atlanta.
Yeah.
I'll try to remember to pack.
I think that'll go over well. I think you should also, while you do that, make sure you lecture on the spirituality of the church. I think that'll go over really well.
Well, it's going to be in there somehow. Yeah.
Sure. Fosdick, let's get into the details a little bit here. We'll come right back around eventually to Machen, because it always comes back to Machen in one way, shape, or form. I suppose we should begin, Darryl, and you do this in the course that's going to be coming out in a couple months that you just taught. You distinguish between the modernist fundamentalist controversy and more specifically, the Presbyterian controversy or the Presbyterian conflict. Why is it important to distinguish those, even though we recognize that there is some significant overlap between the two?
Well, it seems to me if you emphasize the fundamentalist controversy, you lose the specifics of what Machen was up to. Of course, you also then lump Machen in with characters that I myself would be uncomfortable with. I'd rather protect Machen from those associations, even from somebody like William Jennings Bryan, who was notable, I think, in important ways in his opposition to teaching evolution at the Scopes trial, even though that can be caricatured. There were dynamics of that trial, such as the textbook they were using in Dayton, Tennessee, or throughout Tennessee, included eugenics. That was a big part of biology at the time.
Yeah.
Eugenics now looks a lot creepier mm-hmm. than it did then. And to Brian's credit, he saw that. But even then, Brian was not a confessional Presbyterian. He came to the church out of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. He was much more of a social kind of, kind of a progressive in some ways. And he and Machen were just not on the same page. But if you then put them on the same page, well, does that mean that Machen also holds the most of the views that Brian did, and that Brian in turn holds the most of the views that Machen did? Well, that's just not the case. So how do you recover some kind of variety, specificity in that? And I've been writing about confessional Protestantism now throughout much of my days as a historian, and I mean, thinking about Machen and in that context as an old school Presbyterian or as a confessional Protestant was partly how I got thinking about why denominational categories matter, and that the larger sort of two-party system of understanding what we used to think of American Protestantism, now we have to say white Protestantism, which is fine, because it doesn't always, I mean, that's one of the reasons why these lumping categories don't actually make sense of the Black church either. So you have to say white American Protestantism, but simply dividing that into a conservative and liberal, fundamentalist, modernist, evangelical, liberal dichotomy just doesn't get into other kinds of actors in the world of American Protestantism. Mm-hmm. So even though there are overlaps, there are many more differences, and the controversy itself, I think, developments in the Presbyterian Church itself drove that controversy much more than, say, the Scopes trial or what's his name up in Minneapolis? Baptist
in Minneapolis. Oh, John Piper. Yeah. But this, we're talking. You're not talking contemporary.
The guy who was the head of the World Christian Fundamentals Association.
Oh, I don't know.
The name will come back to me in a second. But all I can think of is J. something Norris, and that's not the right name either. So,
no worries.
Yeah.
So okay, people may not know, or they might wonder why this was such a big deal for Presbyterians, because Harry Emerson Fosdick was a Baptist, but he's at First Presbyterian Church in New York. He's also a faculty member at Union Theological Seminary. First off, how common is this, or how is this possible? This might be difficult for Presbyterians now to understand, but how is it possible that we have a Baptist minister serving as an associate at First Presbyterian Church? What in the world's going on there?
I wish I knew more of the specifics of it. I think it was unusual. And that's why when First Presbyterian took flak for this, they had to back away relatively quickly. And John D. Rockefeller, another Baptist of progressive bent, wound up creating a spot for Fosdick at the Riverside Church, built a whole new facility, and Fosdick became the preacher there. I assume, though, that the connections between First Presbyterian and Union would have been fairly strong, and there was just a camaraderie among progressive Baptists and liberal Presbyterians that they would have not seen that great a difference. In fact, the whole, as I tried to say in the lectures, the whole development from between 1870 and 1920 is to for greater union among the Protestants, so that doctrinal differences really aren't that important. That would mean the Baptist Presbyterian differences aren't that important. Now, I'd be curious to know if while Fosdick was the pastor there, and if he was in the pulpit every week, what he was doing with baptisms. I mean, was he baptizing infants? I don't know. Or did they bring in, they would have had plenty of people, ministers available that they could bring in to do that if Fosdick objected to infant baptism. If he did object to infant baptism, on what grounds, if doctrine really isn't that important? So there's a topic for some seminarian or graduate student, a research paper.
Sure.
Baptisms at First Presbyterian between 1919 and 1922, and who did them? I actually think that would be pretty intriguing.
It wouldn't be too complicated.
How they handled that
that's
the only way I can explain it, is that there was just a milieu in New York City, Manhattan in particular, and First Pres and Union were on it, part of that, and Fosdick was a graduate of Union, was teaching there. I think he was a graduate of Union at some point. No, he did an MA at Columbia. No, he did a BD at Union. So and Union Seminary was a kind of it was a Presbyterian seminary. It was independent, sure. Became independent of the Synod of New York, I believe, in 1890s when Charles Briggs.
Right. They got fed up with all the conflict right. in the
at so
the
they just GA. Decided they to just go left. Out on their own the way Westminster right. would eventually do in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only reason why they just trusted each other, and this seemed like a good move. And Fosdick was considered one of the great orators of that era. So people at First Presbyterian would have been probably thinking this was great. This was like getting, I don't know,
right.
Rick Warren to be your, I don't know who the Tim Keller,
right,
John Piper,
big name. It's I think it's indicative of just what the values are at the time. And there's a lot of the similar themes today regarding evangelicalism, where there isn't a first and foremost a thought about what is the confessional tradition of this body to which I belong or this place where I attend and where I worship. It's more or less about there are many other factors. It could be about a lot of things for various people. I've found this quote from Stonehouse to be rather interesting. This is on page 302, at least of the OPC's latest edition of the Machen bio. And regarding this chapter in the church's life, Stonehouse, he remarks, the ultimate result, accordingly, was that distinctive Presbyterianism was largely given up in favor of broad ecumenism. And at least in Stonehouse's mind, and he would later, at least in two decades, be doing quite a bit of work in ecumenism from a distinctly Reformed confessional perspective. He did a lot of work there. It's really significant work. But at this time in 22, it's just, is this guy's a Baptist, but that's not that big of a deal if he brings these other features or benefits to the table. I don't know, maybe to use a not very well developed or thought out sports analogy, you know, would the Bears complain, or would the Bears fans complain if we signed Aaron Rodgers? You know, it's like, well, we hate the Packers, but look what this guy can do. You know,
right.
It's like,
right.
And what's he going to bring to the table? We can get over this other stuff. Or in this case, at least in the Presbyterian scheme, I imagine that most people attending that church, I don't know, I don't want to impugn them. I don't know any of them or the history very well, but whether they're at a Presbyterian or Congregationalist or a Baptist church, it might not make that much of a difference week to week to most people.
Right.
So. Right.
Yeah. I doubt that it would necessarily, although again, when it comes to sacraments, Lord's Supper included,
sure,
it might make a difference. Not to say that Presbyterians were overwhelmingly uniform in their practices, but I would imagine that the way Baptists and Presbyterians administered the Lord's Supper would have been different. And how Fosdick handled that. Maybe they brought in one of the other Presbyterian ministers at this large church when you have a staff of five, say, and that person's going to do the supper. And all Fosdick did was preach. And there, the message that he preached probably wasn't that different from what
yeah.
other liberal Presbyterians
no, not at all.
Preach.
We'll get into some of the sermon details at the point, but I'd like to ask you a question just leading off. You taught me something really important years ago. Maybe you don't know this, but just through the Sunday school at Calvary. And you explained to me and to everyone listening the great difference between New York and Philadelphia in Presbyterian history. You said, as a rule of thumb, a heuristic. Generally, anything that comes out of New York in Presbyterianism is not so great. Usually, they're kind of leading the way in terms of the progressive stuff. And then most things coming out of Philadelphia are a lot more, we would be a lot more sympathetic to it. It's kind of a joke, but at the same time, it largely holds up pretty well throughout the early 20th century.
Maybe even the early 21st century.
I'll let you say it.
No, I mean, the old side, new side was largely Philadelphia against New York, Philadelphia being old side and other presbyteries as well. But the synods lined up pretty much that way. Senate of Philadelphia was more old side. The Senate of New York was more new side. New siders were pro-revival. Old siders were skeptical of revival for a variety of reasons. Old school, new school, a similar dimension, even though Albert Barnes, by the way, the Baptist I was trying to recall was William Bell Riley in Minneapolis. But Albert Barnes did actually take a call in Philadelphia, and that was one of the major episodes of the old, leading up to the split in 1837 between old school, new school. Again, revivalism is kind of the backdrop, the so-called second, not so great awakening.
right.
And, but there was also plan of union between Congregationalists and Presbyterians were planting churches in places like Michigan, mm-hmm. Illinois, and Ohio. There were also simmering there theological developments at New Haven that really did see the New York. I mean, when the old school extended synods and presbyteries, it was largely New York that they got rid of.
Right.
And then, you know, you have in the so-called fundamentalist but better Presbyterian controversy of the 1920s, it's New York that is the home to liberalism, and Philadelphia is the Presbytery that's making the most noise to try to resist it. First with Clarence McCartney, who preaches a sermon in response to Fosdick. I think it's called Shall Unbelief Win?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then when eventually Machen's trial comes about in 1935, he tries to get ahead of the law and transfer his credentials to Philadelphia, where the Presbytery, being as conservative as it was, chances are they would not have brought him to trial, or if there had been a trial, he might not have been convicted.
Right.
So for whatever, I think part of the reason is ethnic Scotch-Irish and Scots maybe were more confessional, doctrinal than New England, which sort of seeped down to New York. That's one way that I've read it. And the New England Puritans, I mean, New England Puritans and Presbyterians in Scotland and England were all hot Protestants of a kind. But the way you sort out the hotness, the heat, with the coolness of doctrine and church order, I think the Scots and the Scotch-Irish came down more on the side of order and stability and doctrine. And sometimes the pietism of Puritans could, without some kind of ecclesiastical oversight, because you have a congregational polity that lets individual congregations run the show.
Sure.
You know, I think there's greater chance of more diversity and perhaps greater trend toward liberalism. But so that's how that geographical alignment works out.
But the problem in New York is happening here with a Presbyterian church. Another Stonehouse quote, he says, the fact that a minister not even subject to the authority of Presbytery and General Assembly, speaking of Fosdick, that he should have used a Presbyterian pulpit to make what was widely regarded as an attack upon the Constitution disclosed a situation bordering on lawlessness. I mean, this is what's so atypical, and we need that research assistant or enterprising young student to go do this work for us. And maybe it's been done. If it has, write in. Let us know. I'd like to have the sources and be able to read up on this, on what was going on and what First Presbyterian Church was doing, how this worked within Presbyterian polity to have a Baptist associate minister. But he's not accountable, not just to the local church. Presbyterian ministers traditionally are members of the presbytery, but here we have a man serving as an associate minister. He's not accountable to the church where he's working. And then to use that pulpit, Stonehouse says, to effectively attack the Presbyterian standards, the confessional standards, he says, bordering on lawlessness. So I guess my point here is, even within a church that supposedly is supposed to have a firm and well thought out and developed polity, you still see this stuff happening.
Yeah. And this is where, as I was writing this week about the piece for RTS, I do wonder, and I didn't have enough time to go into the Fosdick side of things and even to look at some of the biographies of Fosdick. And unfortunately, the biographies that are available online only give you a limited preview. But I do wonder if Fosdick was really thinking about Presbyterianism at the time, because in the Baptist world, going back at least to 1920, if not to 1919, with, again, William Bell Riley, with founding the World Christian Fundamentals Association, T.T. Shields up in Toronto is another prominent conservative Baptist. There are rumblings in the Southern Baptist Convention with J. Frank Norris, who has, he has two congregations, one in Fort Wayne, I believe, and one in Detroit, of all things. He's commuting even, I guess, well before John Ockenguy.
Harold.
He's commuting between Boston and Pasadena when he's pastor of Park Street and also president of Fuller in the 40s.
Right.
Harold John Ockenguy, excuse me. But so there are elements in the Baptist world that are becoming much more alarming. And Fosdick, just before this, had visited China, and he'd seen, I think, again, what was happening among Baptist missionaries in China and so-called fundamentalists trying to keep certain developments from happening there, which is also curious because China is going to be going to become a big part of the 1930s controversy for Machen and the independent board and what's happening on the mission field there with the and the rethinking missions report that kicks off that side of the Presbyterian controversy. But I suspect, and also in that Baptist world are maneuvers to oppose evolution in public schools and also in Baptist colleges, so that Tennessee is one among many states that tries to restrict the teaching of evolution in public schools. These are Southern states, and probably a lot of Southern Baptists are involved in them. So I suspect Fosdick may have used the pulpit that morning to take a shot at the Baptist world, even though he doesn't mention any denomination. And Presbyterians in the pews there may have thought, what's he talking about? Uh-huh. Well, he's making a nice point about toleration and love and charity. And so that sounds good. But you know, and Fosdick, I think, kind of stepped in it because he didn't recognize that he was in a Presbyterian pulpit, and his session was accountable to Presbytery, which is accountable to the Synod, which has all sorts of other jurisdictional aspects to it. So he may have not intended to kick off this controversy among Presbyterians. He may have intended it much more to be a shot at conservative Baptists.
Fosdick writes, ostensibly, this is a sermon from Acts 5, 38 and 39, but it... there's a very little Bible in this, so here's the pretext for his screed. So in the present case, I tell you, keep away from these men and let them alone, for if this plan or this undertaking is of man, it will fail. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them. You might even be found opposing God. He's quoting Gamaliel in Acts 5, 38 and 39. Now, Fosdick is kind of throwing this out seemingly to kind of speak about the conservative people that are yipping and yapping about things and also about the liberals. So this question's going both ways here, where you have certain people presenting. I find this ironic that he quotes this, because the case that he's making about liberalism could be flipped on its head. And things will get panned out in the end. They will pan out in the end, in which the truth of God will be revealed and exonerated. He writes just at the beginning in the first section here, "This morning we are to think of the fundamentalist controversy which threatens to divide the American churches as though already they were not sufficiently split and riven. A scene suggestive for our thought is depicted in the fifth chapter of the book of Acts, where the Jewish leaders have before them Peter and other of the apostles, because they have been preaching Jesus as the Messiah. Moreover, the Jewish leaders proposed to slay them. When in opposition Gamaliel speaks, refrain from these men and let them alone, for if this counsel or this work be of men, it will come to naught. But if it be of God, ye cannot overthrow it, lest haply ye be found even to fight against God. Then Fosdick continues, one could easily let his imagination play over this scene and could wonder how history would have come out if Gamaliel's wise tolerance could have controlled the situation. For though the Jewish leaders seemed superficially to concur in Gamaliel's judgment, they nevertheless kept up their bitter antagonism and shut the Christians from the synagogue. We know now that they were mistaken. Christianity, starting within Judaism, was not an innovation to be dreaded. It was the finest flowering out that Judaism had ever had. When the master looked back across his heritage and said, I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill, he perfectly described the situation. The Christian ideas of God, the Christian principles of life, the Christian hopes for the future were all rooted in the Old Testament and grew up out of it. And the master himself, who called the Jewish temple his father's house, rejoiced in the glorious heritage of his people's prophets. Only he did believe in a living God. He did not think that God was dead, having finished his words and works with Malachi. Jesus had not simply a historic, but a contemporary God, speaking now, working now, leading his people now from partial into fuller truth. Jesus believed in the progressiveness of revelation, and these Jewish leaders did not understand that. Was this new gospel a real development which they might welcome? Or was it an enemy to be cast out? And they called it an enemy and excluded it. One does wonder what might have happened had Gamaliel's wise tolerance been in control. So he's pleading for tolerance and a much wider view of the theories acceptable within the church. This is going to lead into, in the next year, the Auburn Affirmation, right? And which is in response to, in large measure, the five fundamentals and all of those that which wasn't a Presbyterian thing, although it came into play with the licensure of several of these guys who would not affirm the virgin birth. Anyway, it's all part and parcel, but here the basic core is that Fosdick is pleading for tolerance, but he's got an edge to him too. I mean, it's not just, the sermon isn't just like, can't we all just get along? It's not a Stuart Smalley kind of nice guy, saccharine, sappy thing. He's got an edge to it. But oddly enough, the case that he makes, you know, if this is of God, then it will endure. We'll be found opposing God if it is of God, but indeed, as our conviction would hold, the liberalism will be shown to not be of God. Classic liberalism will ultimately fail. And we're seeing kind of the wreckage of that now and still trying to pick up the pieces. How does this sermon fit in? I mean, let's not be anachronistic, but knowing what comes in 23 and on into 24, we certainly see the seeds of it here with Fosdick. How aware are these Auburn affirmationists later on using Fosdick's words as kind of a call, a siren call to, or a trumpet blowing to calling the troops to action?
Yeah. I don't think Fosdick was on the cutting edge with this in any way. I think, William R. Hutchinson, there's only one N in his name. He was a famous historian of liberalism at Harvard Divinity School with whom I had the honor of studying. But I mean, his history of modernism, which is The Modernist Impulse in American Protestantism, is the name of his 1976 book, which I still think reads really well, and it's a lineage of liberal Protestant developments from Unitarians down to the modernists, even down to neo-Orthodox. It's a really good intellectual history. But so Fosdick was just picking up on the kinds of categories that liberal Protestants had been making for probably 30 to 40 years.
Sure.
As they were trying to maintain their standing in American society as an informal establishment,
yeah,
running a lot of really important institutions, especially in higher education, and trying to separate, say, the, and this is what Machen describes at the beginning of Christianity and Liberalism. How do you kind of adjust to modern learning, biblical criticism, Darwinism, but even beyond that, engineering, yeah, all sorts of things that, well, are, that are occurring.
If I may, Fosdick quotes that very thing just to get what was on his mind. He says, a great mass of new knowledge has come into man's possession. New knowledge about the physical universe, its origin, its forces, its laws. New knowledge about human history, and in particular about the ways in which the ancient peoples used to think in matters of religion and the methods by which they phrased and explained their spiritual experiences. And new knowledge also about other religions and strangely similar ways in which men's faiths and religious practices have developed everywhere. So, you know, this is the idea of modernism. It's not just affecting religion or spirituality. It's a whole worldwide cultural movement in all disciplines, the arts, sciences. I mean, everything is flipped on its head. It's a very transitional time period. Fosdick is aware of that, but they want to, in many ways, kind of reorient religion in light of this supposed new knowledge, and at least make room within the church. And the church is, he does comment on the Presbyterian and the Baptist churches. There needs to be room for people to be able to develop their views and have the leeway to do so without being kicked out by these meanies.
Right. And a big strategy of this is sort of to separate the kernel from the husk. And liberal biblical scholars, higher critics have been doing that with the Bible going back to the 19th century. But, you know, it in some ways it's we all do this to a certain extent, it seems to me, that we look at something that was written at a specific time, and if that document looks out of tune with our time, then you have to sort of interpret that as merely coming out of that specific moment, and we can try to find the general truths in it, but not the particulars. The progressives politically did this with the Constitution. They tried to say that the Constitution was written at a time when Newtonian science was dominant, but now that we lived in a time of evolutionary or biological science, right, it didn't make sense to think about society in terms of physics as opposed to biology. And so Fosdick and liberal Protestants are doing similar things with documents that come out of the 17th century, say with the Westminster Standards. And even in our own circles in the OPC, I can remember back to the 80s when some more progressive types in our circles, I won't mention names, but would say that, you know, white suburban churches are sort of products of a kind of 17th century mindset, and they're not properly responding to developments in the city, to developments of racial and ethnic differences, etc. I mean, so that it's easy maybe is too strong, but it's a common way to sort of get out from under the authority of a constitutional document like the standards. So to sort of just say, oh, we're going to appropriate the spirit of the Bible or the spirit of the Westminster Confession, but we're not going to get bogged down in the particulars. And Machen says precisely that he gives liberalism credit for doing this, but he says, he wonders if what you have left after you've done this is still really Christianity. I mean, so he's trying to raise the cautionary warning that, okay, you try to separate Christianity from science. You try to separate Christianity from history. What do you have left? What do you have left is kind of generic sentimental uplift of human goodness and aspiration. Well, that's not exactly Jesus came to die for sins.
Yeah.
So Fosdick, I don't think, is really doing anything that unusual. It's, right. Again, he's just, but I think you're right. There is a tone.
He
to
just
it
struck
that,
a chord.
That he is being provocative, and he's also condescendingly provocative
because
you know, we know better than those people
right
what this is, but we're going to be charitable to them because we're going to be tolerant and loving. Although it turns out it's not going to be that tolerant because those people are really fools. Right. So why would you listen to them?
I've got this working theory, just teaching a course on OPC history at my church. And then, you know, developing a lot of these thoughts over and over. I think inherently one of the big features that you have whenever you're dealing with the battle with liberalism is there tends to be what I call a soft middle. And it's moderates, you might find, but it's also conservatives who are swayed. They either don't want to act. It could be out of laziness. It could be the fact that they don't have a stomach for fighting for the truth and sticking up for these things. But a lot of it, I think, is just that people want to be nice and they succumb to these arguments that people like Fosdick and Erdman, Stevenson eventually make. The soft middle frequently is persuaded by these arguments of, can't we all just get along? You know, we're not saying we agree with these liberal theories or these liberal positions, but do we really want to kick them out and eliminate them? Let's just have a larger tent. Let's be accepting and welcoming, and let's try to win our brothers over if that's something we need to do. And there are folks that a majority of the church is neither on the far left or the far right, whatever sides you want to categorize those as. But it seems to me that the conservative viewpoint, the doctrinalist type of position, is always fighting an uphill battle because they inevitably have a harder time making the case with the so-called soft middle. Right. Those folks are automatically more inclined to listen to the way that the liberals argue. In terms of just let us stay. We're not trying to change everyone to have our views, but please just don't kick us out. Whereas the conservatives are saying, not only is our view the true view, but it's also the view of our Constitution, and we don't have room for views that deny this. So they sound exclusionary and mean, even though they're just trying to hold the church to what the church has already agreed to do.
Right. And the other side of this, too, is that liberals can sound, and I think they do believe in certain kind of vague Christian notions, whether, you know, sovereignty of God, they could affirm that. They could affirm love of neighbor, love of God, the Ten Commandments. And so, you know, somebody in the pew, the soft middle, somebody who really doesn't want to fight or have to study to figure out what the controversy is. And there are parts of life where we all do that.
Those obviously. Affirmations are good enough for them.
Yeah. I mean, lots of people during pandemic just said, what Dr. Fauci says is fine. And I mean, you know, to spend time to try to find out what was going on with masks or something else would take time. You'd have to. So I can understand why people don't want to do that.
Sure.
And then on the other hand, somebody like Fosdick sounds sort of agreeable. He's not denying God. He's not denying Jesus. He's not outright denying these things. So he must be okay. So we don't really need to worry about it. That's why also Machen has to kind of kick it into high gear. But I also think he's right. I don't think he was doing this just for rhetorical sake. No, this is another religion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not like a shade of, this is another religion.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
And you could say that that's really raising the stakes. And he was, but he also thought that this was a serious threat to Christianity. So then that goes back to a question. Well, what is Christianity? What is orthodoxy? How do you define it? And again, does a soft middle want to spend the time thinking about that?
Mm-hmm.
And have they been sufficiently fed to be able to do that? You would think they would if they had grown up and been catechized and all that good stuff that Presbyterians believe in, but chances are they weren't.
Certainly wasn't happening in droves in amongst many of the families, no doubt at First Presbyterian Church in New York. But there's this, I've got a point in asking this question. I don't want to take ourselves too far afield, but I think this might be an interesting question to, for contemporary reasons. And I think it might tie up a few loose ends here. So we're talking Fosdick, modernism, all the changes in the world in the early 20th century. Machen is no fuddy-duddy, you know, in the sense that he's not just kind of burying his head in the sand. He's very intelligent. He's aware of cultural developments. He's a cultured person, and from a cultured family. So he's not an isolationist in that sense. He's not a fundamentalist. He wouldn't even, as you make the case, it's not even a great way to characterize him. But there's this growing thesis among James Eglinton and many of his students that are presenting a thesis about Bavinck, which is quite interesting in many respects, regarding Bavinck being orthodox and modern. Their argument, in a nutshell, and forgive me if I'm being oversimplistic, this isn't my intention, but Bavinck is confessionally conservative and orthodox. He's not departing from historic Reformed Christianity. But yet he also is very involved in the advances in the sciences, even into psychology and biology and other fields, seeking to apply and advance orthodox and conservative confessional Christian theology in light of this new knowledge. So there's growing interest in studying Bavinck from that perspective. People have seen Kuyper trying to do a lot of things like that. Daryl, I'm curious how you categorize or understand Machen with regard to this, because he's not Kuyperian or neo-Kuyperian in this sense. I would suspect you would say that that's not the case. But how would you characterize Machen and his engagement with the modern world? And is that a third way? It's not liberalism. Maybe it's not Kuyperianism of a sort. What is it? 2K?
It How can't would you be a third way. No. Third ways are bad. I mean, here I wonder if you could also argue Warfield kind of fits the Bavinck model. I mean, Warfield was trying to learn from evolutionary science and trying to say we'll try to accept as much of that as possible, because it seems to be a reflection of what general revelation is telling us now with further advances in biology, etc. But he wanted to draw the line about certain elements of Genesis 1 and 2 narratives. Where does the soul originate? Can the soul simply emerge from natural developments, or does there have to be an intervention from God for the creation of the soul in humans? But the difference here for Machen and Warfield compared to, say, Kuyper and Bavinck, I wonder if it has to do with philosophical commitments. And I don't want to step on anyone's toes, since I know you guys are big Vantillian and Vossian types, but the common sense realist tradition, I wonder if it stays in lanes more than, say, the philosophical idealist tradition in the sense of worldview and your Christian outlook, then begins to inform all that you do. And I wonder if in the Presbyterian world and a common sense realist view, you know, you do one thing in this sphere, you think a certain way, you think a certain fear over here. There's not an effort to try to integrate it as much. And I think I see that in Machen, that he's well read in lots of things, but when he testifies before the Senate over the Federal Department of Education, when he writes a letter to the governor of Pennsylvania about blue laws and Sabbath day laws, he's much more sort of measured and stays within the confines of the debate. What does the Constitution of the United States allow? What's good for the health of Pennsylvania society when it comes to blue laws or something? And I'm not saying that Bovink or Kuiper didn't do that. Obviously, Bovink and Kuiper had way more political responsibility than Kuiper or Warfield or Machen ever had. Mm-hmm. So they were capable of making arguments that could win elections and persuade other members of parliament or something. But I still wonder if there is a kind of philosophical or even political tradition that enables Machen and Warfield, for instance, to go along with certain advances in learning, but also leave that in its different category. And that's not really Christianity. It's part of general revelation. It's part of other developments. And it can be good or bad, and it could be hostile to Christianity in some way. But we don't necessarily try to baptize it. I wonder.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. This is a large question. Maybe we'll finish on this. Where do you find the ghost of Fosdick or the spirit of Fosdick most evident in the contemporary church? And where do you find, if anywhere, kind of the spirit of Machen? Put it another way, this is a counterfactual, hypothetical question. You know, maybe it could be developed in a fictional film someday, but if Fosdick were alive today, where would he be? What would he be doing? And what about Machen? How would we see them? How would we categorize them today? Is there a place for them? Or are they just not only historically of a different era, but also of just kind of a different makeup, different stripe where they don't fit in? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, one way of sorting that out comes to the importance of controversy. And I geared my lectures for you around Machen and controversy and what made him willing to fight and what did he fight. And some of this was to own perhaps John Frame's piece, Machen's Warrior Children, and to say, no, that actually...
You still have your challenge coin? Because we did, for our first Reform Forum conference, mint, you know, a bunch of Machen challenge coins, Machen's face, and said Machen's Warrior Children around there. So we sent you one. I mailed you
one. I don't
know
that I've seen that.
Yeah, I mailed you one. So maybe it got lost in the mail, or maybe Anna.
Well,
has it.
I don't know where I put it then. I need to look for it. But
I might have one left at home, yeah. Like one extra. But
I might have it at home around my desk.
These are very rare things. So
yeah, I'll look for that.
It's worth more than a Bitcoin.
I sort of recall now seeing it. Sorry, but I mean, and I'm also sort of thinking now about controversy in the PCA.
Sure.
Over side B and the way I think that, say, people like Frame and Tim Keller even sort of ill-prepared the PCA for the kind of controversy they're now facing, because there was a sense in which there was a welcoming of diversity in the church.
Right.
And let's not fight about things that aren't as important was the message of, say, Frame in 2003 with his Machen Warrior Children piece, and then Keller in 2010 writes a piece like what's so great about the PCA or something like that. So if it simply comes to understanding that controversy is going to be essential, Machen writes, you can't turn the pages of the New Testament without hitting controversy. Mm. Christianity is always going to be controversial in a certain sense, and contending for the truth is always going to be important. Obviously, you have to pick your battles. Obviously, you have to have discernment about what's key and what's not. And I think in Machen's case, the people who want to say, you know, okay, somebody who denies the virgin birth of Christ or somebody who denies the deity of Christ, well, that's just too far. But Machen was actually battling about something much bigger that was compromising the witness of the church more generally. A kind of progressive Protestantism, a progressive social gospel movement. that was also fueling Fosdick. So is there a sense of needing to be on guard in the world? Machen had it. Where he got it comes from a different variety of sources. And someone like Fosdick, who was a modernist, and part of Hutchison's definition of modernism is recognizing that the advances in the modern world are outworkings of the kingdom of God. Mm. So they saw, you don't have to be on guard about this. We want to be on the side. We want to sort of follow the arc of history, to use President Obama's phrase. And they weren't on guard about that. And people who were on guard, like the fundamentalists or Brian or Machen, well, these people were reactionaries or Neanderthals in some way. So that's a difference. And I think what makes our current time somewhat different now, and I'm still not sure I buy entirely Aaron Wren's the three worlds of evangelicalism, the positive world, negative world, neutral world. But I think he's onto something when he talks about post-2014, the United States has entered a different era where so many things are contentious and seen to be by progressives or social justice types as just completely wrong, if not wicked, if not oppressive, et cetera. That's a different sort of understanding of things than existed, at least in my lifetime. Mm. I mean, you saw elements of this in the 60s and 70s, certain radical groups, but the way that big companies, news outlets, universities jumped onto this after, especially after George Floyd in 2020, but also with mm-hmm. opposition to Donald Trump as president. And I'm not saying that Christians should support Trump, and I'm not saying that Christians should support abusive police by any means. But the way that those things have been settled seemingly by large institutions has made it really hard for Christians to speak in ways that they had before this, and to think about the role of the church in this world. Is it going to be adversarial? Does it have to be sort of like Rod Dreher's Benedict Option, where we need to retreat from mainstream society and form our own institutions to perpetuate the faith? These are live questions now that hadn't been asked prior, say, to 2015. and I think Machen was aware, though, of those difficulties, and that there may need to be retreat to a Westminster, to an Orthodox Presbyterian church, to an independent board for Presbyterian foreign missions, to the importance of families, parents rearing their children and not letting merely the experts in public schools do it. So, I mean, that outlook was part of Machen's outlook, and it was part of an outlook among conservative Presbyterians, even in the PCA, even though they weren't in Machen's communion. Conservative Presbyterians had that too in their battles with liberalism in the Southern Church, 50s, 60s, 70s. And it's now become much bigger, and I think it's become much more obvious in our own time. And I guess the legacy of Machen would be, in some ways, in this setting, figuring out the ways to continue to fight that battle.
Yeah.
And I don't know where the Fosdicks would be in the current environment. Other than, boy, I don't even know.
Would he have a gig on cable news? Would he be commenting? Would he be writing books? Would he be doing self-help?
I guess one example that I think of, and I'm not saying this to be inflammatory, but the way that the mainline churches have embraced the LGBTQ phenomenon, and you'll see the gay pride flags, if that's what they're called, but the gay that the rainbow flag outside mainline churches and sure. the very welcoming, affirming, I really do think that's where Fosdick would be,
right?
So that's one example, and that's where I think a side of mainline Protestantism that still continues to think of this trajectory of progress and movement to greater freedom, greater truth, greater justice in some way. And somehow they also think about that movement as everything before now was entirely bad. So it's almost like we've started from scratch. So that's not really progress. This is revolution, not progress. But Fosdick would have tried to see all this as progress, which is precisely what President Obama did with the Obergefell decision. This was another sign in this, or another step in the outworking of greater rights and freedoms for Americans who have been denied these rights and freedoms, which was a very different argument from, say, someone like Andrew Sullivan, Roman Catholic, gay, conservative of a kind, journalist, writer, editor, who argued way back in 1997, six, I think, a book called Virtually Normal, that the case for gay marriage there was, this was a way of making especially gay men more domestic, taking them out of the bars and putting them into homes and having committed relationships the way that heterosexual people have, and viewing marriage as a source of stability, and in a certain sense as a institution of restraint upon desires that can lead to some kinds of harms and ways of life that aren't as valuable as they might be. But that's not the way people have regarded Obergefell. So that was the only point I was making.
Sure. That's good. Well, it's an interesting thought experiment to think about the past and figures of the past, notable figures like Harry Emerson Fosdick, J. Gresham Machen, and others, and what we can learn from them for the present. That's in many ways the role of studying history. I think it was Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, who said, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it surely rhymes. And, you know, there are many lessons to be learned. It was George Santayana, I think, that famously said, those who do not learn the lessons of history or the lessons of the past are doomed to repeat them. But I constantly know that. And I pretty much everyone I've ever heard that read and appreciated Christianity and liberalism remarks how contemporary it sounds.
Right, right.
And there's something to that. Because what Machen was fighting is not merely some historicized form of doctrine, but at root is really a different religion, is a form of unbelief. That's what Clarence McCartney was getting at in response to Fosdick's sermon, Shall Unbelief Win? He asked the question. McCartney, good friends with Machen. So there's a lot to be said. There's a lot to study there. Do you know anything about this online symposium? Will there be anything recorded or the publications be made available for people who might want to follow up with RTS?
I don't know about any recordings, and I think it's going to be part of the online journal.
Okay.
RTS has, and I think it's supposed to be published even.
So you're not delivering the paper. You wrote the paper. Okay.
No, I think it's going to be published tomorrow, May 20th, Friday, May 20th, I think is what they're shooting for.
We'll put a link to that in the episode description as soon as we have one available. I'll try to include as well a PDF of Fosdick's sermon if I'm able. I typeset one for a Sunday school class I taught, so I think I can just put that up there, and it's well within the public domain by now. But anyway, there's a lot to learn, a lot to follow up with. And we encourage you to visit us online and follow up with any comments or questions or suggestions. But Daryl, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for 2 weeks in a row. We'll give you a break from me here next week, but maybe the week after that we'll have you back.
No, I think you need a break from me, but no, it's good to be with you again. Good to see you. And thanks again for a wonderful time last week in Libertyville.
Yeah, you bet. You need to do some, I'll do some my own, but you do your research too. Next time we meet up, we'll talk about the glorious founding of Libertyville, Illinois, and all of its Christian America ideals, perhaps, if that's what's in the past. I'm assuming that's what it's about. We'll see.
Right.
The history, we'll be told eventually. So thanks so much, everyone, for watching and listening. We really greatly appreciate it. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.